This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 30th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 247 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on the show, we'll meet writer and ex-Marine Phil Clay, whose new collection of stories, Redeployment, has been called the best thing written so far on what the Iraq War did to people's souls.
Then acclaimed biographer Andrew Lycett will be here to tell us about his current preoccupation, the eccentric Victorian novelist Wilkie Collins.
And later in the show, we'll meet the curator of a new exhibition bringing the works of Rwandan photographers to international audiences for the first time.
All that plus our usual look ahead to next week's top stories and some music too. That's all to come here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Oh, it's been such a busy week. If I was talking at the rate at which the week progressed, then I'd be talking about this fast.
I think I've got a twitch in my eye after this week.
I've had a bit of one of these funny eyelid flutters. I haven't been flirting with you across the desk, Andrew.
I thought, whew, what's going on here?
Just can't stop winking at you. But by the way, that is my feet right now. That you can feel that.
That's your feet.
That's what you call intimate radio. Radio is an intimate medium. I'm just trying to make it that little bit more intimate, right?
Yes.
One show at a time.
It's been a very busy week. Finished an issue. Should have finished, well, a lot more of the book than we have.
Yeah.
Sorry, Gestalten. It's going to be ready on the right day.
Sorry, Gestalten.
Going tonight to Lisbon.
Oh, yeah.
We have
a subscriber
party.
Brought your dancing shoes?
I brought my swimming trunks.
You're going to wear them to the party?
Yeah.
Okay. That's making parties an intimate medium. One party at a time.
It's a Victorian all-in-one with matching hat. It's fine.
Okay. I'm going to enjoy watching the wool cling to you when you walk out the sea.
Okay. And
Darcy-like. You walked out of the sea.
So yeah, it's been busy.
It's been a rip-roaring week. I think we've ticked. If we were the kind of men that had lists, we would have ticked a lot of things off those lists.
I am a man who has a list.
I've got a list there as my note, but that's next month. That's how organised I am.
I was going to say, your list still looks quite long. Anyway. Yes.
It's just the way I've arranged my bit of paper.
So that's our business. Plus, we had very good live sessions, thanks to you this week. I like the Pierces. We're not going to hear them on the show.
It's going to be tomorrow's culture show, actually. Premiering tomorrow at 1900 hours GMT. Is that what we sort of call it? Or do we call it BST? I don't know what it is. I thought that was Mad Cow Disease. The Pierces.
Very friendly, nice people.
They were quite friendly, it has to be said.
Okay. We'll leave that there.
I think this is one of the most unprofessional interviews ever conducted. It's not my fault. I think they were jet lagged and frisky.
Those two
sisters from Alabama.
You had something in both eyes when they came in.
What was that
laugh? That's the dirtiest laugh I've ever heard.
I don't know. Something that you get from hanging out on the Monocle editorial floor, I think.
Talking of dirty,
let's get him out.
Ladies and gentlemen, please make yourselves at home. It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
You, I know that you paid for that that promo yourself, Tom.
Yeah.
You're going to get one member of staff to clap at the end of it.
I know. It wasn't even a round of applause.
It was literally the sound of one hand clapping.
Yeah. I like a hand clap, you know, in its musical application, but that was a bit underwhelming.
That, by the way,
I quite like the music, though.
That was quite rousing.
I think that there should be ladies with little feathers and things behind you.
Hmm. Well, don't break the illusion.
Feather dusters.
That's probably what the listeners...
People probably think that.
That's probably what the listeners think is happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's happening next week?
Well, I thought we'd start... One thing I think is interesting today, you alluded to earlier, you know, you're struggling to remember GMT, BST. The clocks all change. I think it's interesting in Crimea that today marks the day when they're changing by 2 hours to go on to Moscow time.
Oh.
Happens officially.
Okay.
Today, obviously, you know, the parliament decided it right after this referendum to join Russia. It puts them out of sync with all around the region. That area is, but it's probably literally and metaphorically a bit of a minefield at the moment. Certainly, timing wise.
That's kind of one of those things that's that must be the most evocative, strange thing about suddenly being under the yoke of another power is suddenly having to change your time when you're completely unused to doing that. Imagine if suddenly we got swallowed up by New York. And we had to suddenly, it's like we wake up in the morning and it's like 2 a.m. or something.
Yeah. Well, no overnight change. It's extraordinary.
That's really horrible.
Yeah. I'm going to say something now which is probably incorrect. Doesn't China have kind of like any one or two time zones? And actually most people are stuck on the same time zone. So it's like Beijing time, I think.
It's interesting. It's like the idea that a society only functions if you're literally running to the same clock. I mean, you need to be slightly more enlightened, I would say, Vladimir Putin, if he's listening.
Even little England had different times.
That can't be right, Andrew.
It's back in the 1500s. If you went down to Cornwall, it was like 200 years different to the time it was in London. Actually, it still is, I think.
I thought he was going to do something like that.
We're going to win friends in the West Country that way, Andrew,
exactly.
Are we?
What about our big listenership in Penzance?
I'm going to go invite them all down to come on the bus.
What bus?
What, on the Sharabank?
On the Sharabank.
The monobus.
No, when Monocle does its tour in Truro, yeah. I'll be careful.
Yeah. You're going to get put. They still put people in the stocks there.
Next, Tom.
Well, some other couple, you know, I like to keep you abreast of, you know, big electoral happenings. The French, Parisian mayoral race, and we will know by maybe the end of the day, but probably more like tomorrow morning. Who's won?
And is this a sort of, is this like the Istanbul election that's also happening today?
It's interesting.
Is it a bellwether for the country?
Well,
what is
interesting, it'll be the first with the first woman to run Paris, either way, mm-hmm. because of these two we have. And they're quite interesting characters. You know, there's a sort of business-like socialist, Anne Hidalgo, or there's a sort of more youthful conservative who everyone thinks is just sort of going through this process so that she can have a tilt at the presidency one day. And she's not really denied that charge. That's Nathalie Kosciusko-Morizet, usual spelling. So that's interesting. But I've got lots of other things. Should we just keep rushing? I've got lots of items.
Just keep going. I love that. Tick.
So tomorrow, this is a little local, and I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to lack an international element.
Was it happy hour at the Tudor Rose?
Oh, you've already.
Yeah.
Oh, you've been reading my notes.
Yeah, well, I was in there.
No, it's London Live. It's an interesting TV venture. This is one of my sort of alma maters, in fact. So I used to work at The Independent, as did you, Andrew. Now the freewheeling owners of that title and the Evening Standard newspaper are launching a London-only 24/7 TV broadcasting station with news and all sorts of other things.
And it launches this weekend?
It launches this tomorrow, on Monday.
Monday.
I am slightly sceptical about it. But because I wonder how it fits into the sort of tapestry of media that people consume. But I think it'd be very interesting to see how they manage it. And obviously they're quite interesting characters anyway. The
sort of Lebedevs.
Lebedevs, yeah. They're sort of trying to perhaps divest themselves of the independent titles, but they're keen to maintain the more profitable elements, like the Evening Standard, for example. I wonder, will they bring the sort of Evening Standard commercial model of success to this project? Might it be more like the Independent, in which case it could have a few troubles.
Did Lebedevs own the Eye?
Yes.
Yeah, it's all.
That's presumably what it wants to be. It wants to be as good as the Eye, but on the TV. It's Easy on the Eye.
Is it interesting?
Easy on the Eye. Well, they should have got that. Yeah, should have got me in.
They should have done. But the Eye works as a fillet of the Independent.
Yeah.
It's a sort of a digest of the main newspaper, so it has the resources to have good content. Whereas I wonder with the TV whether they have the same.
We did look at the website, didn't we, a few weeks ago?
We had a look,
and thought it looked a bit CBeebies.
Well, it's definitely pitching squarely for the kind of youthful London market, and I wonder, you know, youthful Londoners are. You know, there's an intelligent bunch amongst them. They can consume their media. They would be just as happy listening to the intelligent discussion on Monocle 24 as on some designed for youth pizzazz.
That's always the trick. That's always the problem, isn't it? It's like teenage girls don't read teenage girls magazines, do they? You're always going above what you should be aimed at.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
That's right. And I think it may be slightly short-sighted to believe that people. Who, you know, young people live in cities want something that's fun and all about this. Yeah.
All about skateboarding.
Yeah, I think
and rappers.
What they want is good journalism, just like all of us.
But they're buying in a lot of programmes, aren't they? They're having to buy in stuff from the States. And the interesting thing, that they're quite high up the numbers. I never understand how that works, but they're going to be.
Yeah, because a new channel's just appeared on my Freeview, and it's like it's just after, I don't know, Channel 5 or ITV2.
It's 8.
Eight
on Freeview,
yeah,
which is, you know, that's for, it's a lucky number for a large number of people as well. Anyway, interesting shot of their progress. I think will they carry it off?
Okay,
we'll be
London Live launching tomorrow.
Mm. We'll be watching the telly. No, we won't. We'll be in Portugal.
Yeah,
bye.
Let them have a day of bedding in.
Well, yeah, exactly. See how they go after 24 hours.
Yeah.
A couple of other things. End of the week. I actually think I might have mentioned this before, but it's my favourite sporting event of the year. The Marathon des Sables, you know, the,
oh, yeah, the
Sahara desert-based. Yeah. It's the 29th edition, 6 days. I think this could be one for you, Andrew Tuck. 250 kilometres in 6 days. 50 degrees Celsius.
My friend's done this.
Has he really?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And he didn't.
He's done it twice, actually. Oh, he's also canoed across the Atlantic.
He sounds insane.
He did it before Ben Fogle, by the way, people.
But some people run it in about 18. How fast did he do it?
I don't know. I don't know anything.
Some people
about
run
that.
It in 18 hours.
No,
I don't even understand. Five,
how many marathons is it?
Well, it's 250 kilometers.
That's wrong.
That's correct.
Just do the math.
I do the math. That's how quickly they do it.
No, you say it like math, because that's the phrase.
I know it.
Anyway, so 250 kilometers.
Yep.
In 18 hours.
Yeah. It's because that's about, I think it's about 5 marathons, isn't it? So it's about a 3-hour marathon or under.
Wow.
In those conditions. Yeah. And it's like running up and down dunes and absolutely astonishing. And the battles with
there's, and you get sand
scorpions,
in your shoes.
Sand gets in and everywhere besides, I imagine. You have to wear goggles and all sorts.
Gritty groin.
Gritty groin.
I think groin grit is one of the key.
Golfer's arse.
Golfer's arse. Absolutely astonishing. I'm going to continue to mention that every year when it rolls around, because it's amazing. I'd love to ask your friend about his personal experiences.
Yeah.
Of that event, not just generally.
Yeah, he's that sort of person.
Wow, incredible.
Have you run a marathon?
I've run a couple of marathons,
and he's called Crispin. And he's called Crispin, and you'd thought that name would be sort of just more into sort of performing Shakespeare.
Yeah, maybe you should do Shakespeare on the way around.
I won't tell you what his other one was. I'll tell it when we're doing that.
Do you want one more event just to finish? I know we're time's against us. I thought I should mention this. I've just discovered another event. In its own way, as exotic and as exciting as the Marathon des Sables. Listen to this one. This is happening next Saturday. Just think about this. It's the World Catfish Festival in Belzoni, Mississippi. What an event.
Is that catching them?
Oh, it's more than that.
Or the fish have a festival.
I don't know if some of them do. They're probably kept in a tank. You can eat them. There's a competitive eating contest consuming catfish. They declare Miss Catfish, the winner of there's a pageant.
I don't know. Dress a catfish up.
That's a lady.
Oh.
Who looks
she's
like a catfish.
She's the queen of the catfish people. I don't know. I just think it's incredible. Only a few thousand people started attending in the 70s. These days, 10,000 a year. Not just from all over Mississippi, but from all
catfish
around the globe
are slightly
now.
Terrifying creatures, I think.
Yeah, they have those whiskers.
Yeah.
Seen that there's a type of catfish that has been released in Europe by mistake? And in French rivers now, because they've got no competitors, they are so big that they take out like ducks like that.
Yeah.
There's a very good...
Oh, heavens.
Look on YouTube. Scary.
I might watch that.
I don't want to go to the catfish festival anymore than now.
No.
Oh, God.
We've ended on a bit of a downer. But I liked all the other... Because we've now seen the dark side of that festival.
That's true.
Anyway, woo! Miss Catfish. I'm going to Google her.
Yeah. There's also Little Miss Catfish. Junior element.
Oh, good.
Maybe they could be claimed by one of those oversized catfish.
That's not very nice.
Is it a warning? Well, I'm just worried about... I'm worried about the children, Andrew.
Tom, that's very good, because the last few weeks you've come in here with a bit of a stern face and a short list.
Is that true?
Yeah, but that's a very long list and a very good one.
Good.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Maybe you even have even better music next week.
Fingers crossed.
War literature has a rich history. It seems each conflict spews out a handful of singular voices that capture the reality of boots on the ground in a defining way, from the Great War's Robert Graves to Tim O'Brien, who wrote on Vietnam. But what about the so-called Long War, in which the West is currently still engaged?
Phil Clay is a veteran of the US Marine Corps. He served in Anbar province in Iraq for just over a year in 2007 and 2008. After leaving the Marines, he studied for his MFA and published the story Redeployment in Granta. Since then, he's gone on to publish in outlets from the New York Times to Tin House.
He's now published his collection of short stories set in Iraq and Afghanistan under the title Redeployment. The book is already being hailed as a modern classic of war literature. It's been praised by novelists from Colin McCann Tran and Ben Fountain to Karen Russell and Nathan Englander, while Dexter Filkins of the New York Times called it the best thing written so far on what the war did to people's souls. And Phil Clay joins us on the Monocle Weekly today. Phil, thanks for coming in.
Great to be here. Thank you.
First of all, it's a nice story to turn a piece of writing for Granta, or ended up in Granta,
yeah,
into a book proper as such. Was it always your intention to write it in the way it's written, this series of chapters all written in the first person, different people, different voices?
Well, I started writing not long after I got back from Iraq, and the idea of writing from these different perspectives very quickly became important to me. I was working on a novel at the time, but in terms of how I wanted to answer the kind of questions that I'd come back with, I felt that I needed to explore them from all these kind of different viewpoints, different angles that would hopefully clash.
And what were some of those questions? I mean, the characters sort of run the gamut from junior to senior staff, and
right,
and very personal stories to personalizing the impersonal, not wanting to get too strange and literary with it, but trying to say the unsayable almost. But what were the stories that you came back from Iraq with?
Well, you know, it's incredibly strange to come back from Iraq. During a 13-month tour, you get 2 weeks of leave, and they'll fly you anywhere. One of my Marines went base jumping in Switzerland. But I went home to New York, and you know, a few days before, I'd seen people coming into a surgical facility that I live near, and very terribly injured. And then a couple days later, you get on a plane, you go home, and then you're walking down Madison Avenue in this country that doesn't feel at war at all. And it only gets weirder when you get out of the military, because you know, you're living your life. I went back to New York. And if you don't want to think about war, you don't have to. And yet you know people who are still going overseas time and time again, 5, 6, 7 times. And sometimes very bad things are happening to them. I suppose I could formulate a lot of the questions better now. But I think when I got back, it was just this sort of, what the hell was that? Not just, you know, from my own experience, but also for all the people that I'd met while I was overseas.
So obviously when you came back, you had real stories to tell, and you've chosen to do a fiction book.
Right.
What made you decide that that was a better medium to tell the things that you wanted to tell?
It gets a little dangerous when you tell your own story. You think that you have a certain degree of authority in telling it, right? It helps you tell yourself all sorts of nonsense that you want to believe. But when you're dealing with stories, you're asking people to step into the heads of different characters, different perspectives, people who, you know, the narrators in this book wouldn't necessarily agree with each other about what Iraq meant. And they all have very particular jobs, done at very particular times and a very particular, you know, units that they're with. And so, you know, the reader goes through and gets to see these decisions that they have to make in a very intense, difficult environment, and then how they live with it afterwards. And I wanted people to engage in that. I think that's incredibly valuable.
Can I just pick up on one thing you said earlier about this idea of coming back to New York, and here's a country that in no sense seems to be at war. We have the same issue here in the UK with soldiers obviously returning. And I think that many of them find the situation here even more extreme, because until recently, mm-hmm, it wasn't even allowed for soldiers to wear their uniforms when they weren't on base. You know, so the British public never really kind of had any consciousness about there being anything going on, unless they lived in a military town. If they lived in an Aldershot or something, they may have some awareness of what's going on. But for you, is that the biggest part of it? The way that the society, is that what makes soldiers most angry in a way? That they are seeing death and they're seeing their fellow soldiers be wounded and killed and maimed, and then they come home and there's kind of no one's really that interested, or it seems that no one's that interested.
I mean, you know, some people are. I think certainly if you go overseas and you come back to an apathetic public, particularly if there's been a lot of mismanagement, right, that hits very hard, because it's, you know, it's not the Marine doesn't, it's not like the military sort of gets up and decides, oh, we're going to fight a war now. No, the citizens of a nation are responsible for what that nation ultimately does with its foreign policy and its military. And it's very important that we have an engaged public. It's very important that we have, you know, serious criticism of what's going on, that we hold our elected leaders to account. And if we're going to be able to do that, we need to think very seriously about what these wars mean on a human level.
To go back to the book itself, Phil, it starts with a great line, "We shoot dogs." Where did that come from? Was that always going to be the first line in whether it might be a novel or whether it might be a short story. That first chapter is a very visceral thing, and that opening image is I don't know, it's got an addictive quality to it, and it's got a painterly quality to it. Where did that come from?
So that was the first line I ever wrote. We shot dogs, and you know, a friend of mine had been in the Second Battle of Fallujah, had talked to me about the experience of seeing dogs eating corpses. And shooting them to stop them from doing that. And, you know, for some reason that felt like a kind of an opening of sorts for me, for talking about some of the things that I wanted to deal with. You know, I've always been a dog person myself, as is the narrator of that story. And, you know, that's very much in the moment of somebody just coming home and how that feels and the way in which you've adapted to a world in which you need to tailor your responses to your environment in a particular way, both to the sort of physical realities of dealing with threat and also the kind of moral complications that are involved overseas, and then coming home and trying to recalibrate back to a civilian mode of being.
We quoted there in the introduction this idea of, you know, what the war did to people's souls. I do think that people, when they come back from Iraq, whether it's to, you know, America or any other country, that they can, you know, pop back into society in the end and kind of forget what happened. Or, you know, I always find it remarkable when you speak to, you know, you speak to veterans here who may have fought, you know, even in the Second World War years, and, mm-hmm. you know, and they still kind of find it difficult to talk about what happened maybe 50 years ago or, you know, 40 years ago. Do you think there is a sense that war changes people in a way that is, you know, it's difficult to undo?
It changes people for sure. I mean, Any important experience in somebody's life is gonna do that, and you know, I think many vets feel it changes them for the better. Maybe a hard thing, maybe they come back a little sadder, a little angrier, but also stronger in some ways. And then, of course, for some people, it destroys them. And absolutely, you're not the same person that you were when you come back from something like that. And also, you're not the same person over time, right? As you think about that experience and you talk about it with other people in your life and try and come to some way of understanding what you've been through and what that means about who you are now in relationship to your society.
I wondered also if you have as we asked you at the beginning of this interview why you decided to write a fictional book rather than about your own experience or specific experiences of the people you met in Iraq and worked with in Iraq. But I wonder what sort of responsibility you have, not to the canon of war fiction mm-hmm. as such, but to people, to your colleagues, to your counterparts that served there, to tell stories that are as true as they can be while also being as good as fiction can be.
Well, I think that dealing with the experience as rigorously and honestly as possible, that was what I felt my obligation was. I think that, you know,
because you can't gild the lily too much when it's about something that people are still living through.
It's too important. Yeah. You know, I had this sense that, you know, writing it that, and there's some stories where, okay, that's going to piss somebody off for this reason, that's going to piss somebody off for that reason, but that's fine, right? If you're going to talk about something seriously, you know, you don't want to, I mean, there are different ways of romanticizing war, right? Either as sort of, you know, an arena for displays of valor, or as just kind of this, you know, you go see the heart of darkness and are just forever traumatized and what have you. And I think that dealing with the complexities of what that is and the sort of just diversity of experience and how, you know, the kind of policies that we enact as a nation, how those get played out in terms of human lives, that's the obligation. And that involves telling some really dark stories, particularly if you're talking about a war like Iraq.
Phil, I imagine that your publisher, after seeing these reviews, was very keen to pick up the phone and find out what was going to be book number two and book number three. And I'm sure you don't want to go off and fight another war. So what happens? Do you, you know, you've now made your name with an extraordinary piece of war reporting. Do you find something that's completely different as book two? Are you on that journey already? You're already thinking about what happens next?
I've already been working on something. So we'll see where it goes.
With bullets involved? Or?
I'm being very coy about
okay.
what it
You're
is.
Being coy, isn't it?
I'm trying to protect it.
But presumably, I mean, you said you started writing a novel and then this kind of came along. this presumably colours what your novel becomes, or can you keep those two sides of your brain completely separate?
That novel's gone.
Oh, that novel. Don't even talk about that novel.
That is never coming back.
Well, the book is Redeployment. The author is Phil Clay. Thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break for some music now. And why don't we promote the Culture Show, Andrew, with a bit of music from the Pierces. This is from their last album, You and I, and this is called You'll Be Mine. That was You'll Be Mine from the Pierces. Why don't you tune into the Culture Show tomorrow at 1900 BST GMT? Other timing systems are available.
I'm going to be listening.
Yeah?
Yeah, I love it.
You're a fan of the Pierces, aren't you?
I think they're amazing.
You're down the front.
I went to see them in London about 18 months ago. And then they came back with the other band. What's the other band called?
What other band?
The Blood Red Rose or something. Or the...
Oh, yeah, the James Levy and the Blood Red Rose.
That's right. They're pretty cool. They were good as well. So
it's a double whammy.
Did you? Okay.
Listen to the interview.
Okay.
What are we doing next? We are going to speak to Andrew Lycett, the biographer of the Victorian sensationalist Wilkie Collins, up next.
Ooh.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Our next guest is the biographer Andrew Lycett, who has previously published books on Colonel Gaddafi, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Rudyard Kipling, Ian Fleming and Dylan Thomas. He's now looked to the Victorian era for inspiration and in particular the eccentric novelist Wilkie Collins.
The book is Wilkie Collins, A Life of Sensation, and it's out now in paperback from Windmill Books. And Andrew joins us in the studio. You've concentrated on the rather extraordinary life of Mr. Collins, and one of the facts that's thrown up throughout the book and lots of people have seized on is the fact that he managed to kind of run two households with two very different women, and he was also a little bit of a kind of heavy drinker and liked the odd spot of drugs as well. Did we know much about his life before you started digging into it, or had we always concentrated more on the books, on the woman in white, on his books that became masterpieces?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like lots of things that I write about that, you know, a certain amount is known, and that's what makes it a sort of attractive proposition to write a book. And so I was able to look further into the life of this remarkable novelist. He pioneered a category of writing called sensation novels, and they were sort of designed to get people sort of turning the pages, and that they use all sorts of devices, sort of occult, murder, all sorts of personal, family and marital problems to get people reading them. And you know, they were in a sense not particularly Victorian, and Wilkie Collins himself was not particularly Victorian, because as you've alluded to, he had these two families. In fact, I'm talking to you in the heart of Marylebone, and this was his bailiwick, and he was born in Marylebone, very close to here. He lived for the greater part of his time, his life, in Gloucester Place, which is very close to here. While he was there, he had he lived with one woman. He met her close to here in Howland Street, and lived there. She was a widow, a young widow, and so he took her on board with her young child. But while he was involved in a relationship with her, he was researching a book in Norfolk and came across another woman who he encouraged to come back to London, and actually set her up in a flat in, again, very close to here, not just by the Marylebone Road. So for a period from about 1868, give or take one or two interesting episodes, he was living in one house with one woman, and there was this other woman less than a mile down the road, and she had given birth to three children of his.
So he had a fantastic literary imagination, but a poor geographical imagination. Cast his net very wide. I wanted to ask you about Wilkie Collins, the novelist, and whether you feel that his sort of sensationalist fantastical books accidentally told his own story, actually, that they were full of subterfuge and people creeping about in corridors and listening out in doors and sort of bombastic, sort of slightly evil characters. I'm thinking of Lord Fosco. Was Wilkie Collins an accidental autobiographer?
Well, I think that there certainly were aspects of his sort of personal life in there. But I think that basically he was just a sort of good and ambitious storyteller, and he saw around him all sorts of things going on in Victorian life and culture, and he thought that he could make a story about it. He became quite a close friend of Charles Dickens, and he worked for his magazine Household Words. So there was a sort of journalistic element in what Wilkie Collins wrote, and he latched on to kind of issues of the day. One of them was the problem of people, largely women, but not exclusively, being locked up in asylums by their members of their family, and the sort of key being thrown away. And people did this in order to get to people's fortunes, etc. And this was one of the issues of the time. It was sort of raised in Parliament. It was subject of Times leaders, etc., etc. Wilkie Collins decided to make this a central point in his book, A Woman in White.
A Woman in White, yeah. I wanted to ask you, he was pals with Dickens. They had a rip-roaring time together, didn't they? They went out and did a lot of shagging together.
Yep. Went to Paris a lot.
Yeah, went to Paris. Sounds like a great euphemism. And they came back with the cream to apply. But whereas Dickens was a great chronicler of London, Wilkie Collins was more of a kind of psychological profiler, wasn't he? I mean, he, as you say, he tackled these issues of the day, but sort of at an angle, didn't he? You know, he fictionalised them into sort of fantastical circumstances rather than portraying the life of London as Dickens did.
I can understand why you say that. Yeah, I mean, probably the character of London is more prevalent in Dickens's novels. And yeah, I mean, the great thing about Wilkie really was his plots. Mm. I mean, he put a lot of energy into sort of writing out meticulously, you know, what was going to happen in a book. Yeah, I mean, I think that Wilkie just tried to make the best of his material and make it into great stories. A criticism of him is often that he wasn't actually a great depictor of character. Now, I disagree with that. I mean, you've already mentioned character in The Woman in White, Count Fosco, and he's an amazing creation with his little mice and things like that. And there's also, you know, kind of rogues such as Captain Rag, who called himself a moral agriculturalist in no name. And basically that meant he was a swindler. Yeah. He befriended the heroine of that particular novel. And he's, you know, they're all very well realised.
What do you think made him return to popularity? Because your book charts the fact that actually towards the end of his life, you know, his later books weren't as successful and he kind of fell out of favour a little bit. Why did he enjoy a renaissance in the subsequent years? Because certainly The Woman in White has become something of a classic that, you know,
yeah.
Whenever that book is republished, you know, you get great writers doing the foreword. It seems to have been, had a bit of a renaissance in the last 30 years.
I think that's right, yeah. I mean, you know, his heyday was really the 1860s. I mean, this was the era of his sensation novels. It started with The Woman in White and, in a sense, ended with The Moonstone in 1868. And then he did a number of novels that got sort of increasingly didactic. And, you know, this was commented on at the time. So, you know, his reputation waned slightly. And when he died in 1889, he clearly wasn't as sort of well-known as he had been in his heyday. Subsequently, I mentioned T.S. Eliot. Now, in the 1920s, T.S. Eliot sort of was instrumental in boosting Wilkie Collins a bit. And he compared him with Dickens in an article in the Times Literary Supplement and sort of came down in favour of Wilkie Collins as almost being better than Dickens. But it wasn't really until, I'd say, you mentioned the last 30 years, and I think you're absolutely right, because I think that in around the 1980s, people, particularly in universities and sort of critical readers, began to see that there was an element to Wilkie. He was always writing about people who were sort of slightly marginal characters, slightly kind of on the wrong side of the law. He's also, in many ways, and, you know, this is an interesting fact because, you know, I've had lots of debates about this. Women tend to see this kind of from different perspectives. But he was basically a feminist and, you know, he wrote very interesting female characters. And I think that in universities, people have picked up on this aspect of things. There is a sort of a feminist, a kind of modernist aspect to his novels that, you know, people find very attractive.
And we said in the introduction that you've written about Conan Doyle and Kipling as well, two other eminent Victorians. Is it the work of the writers or the life of the writers that attracts you to write these literary biographies?
Well, I came actually from a sort of journalistic background, right. And it's always really a sort of sense that there is more to be told about the life and indeed the works of these people. But yeah, I suppose, you know, there are always people whose works I'm interested in that I want to know more about. That's actually something that I always like to try to convey in my books. Mm. It is a kind of voyage of discovery into the minds and the works of these particular authors.
Because there's always that thing of finding the author very divergent from the works that they make. You know, the life of the author is a sedentary thing.
Yeah.
We're always told. I mean, I think T.S. Eliot actually said that the further the artist separates himself from the art, the life of the artist and the art should be very separate. Whereas clearly Wilkie Collins was often as fantastical as some of his plots. Cool. Well, the book is Wilkie Collins, A Life of Sensation. The author is Andrew Lycett. Thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
The narrative of what's happened to Rwanda since the outbreak of genocide in 1994 has largely been told by foreigners. A new exhibition, however, is putting the story back in the hands of Rwandans. It's called Rwanda in Photographs, Death, Then Life Now, and it shows the progress in the country through the eyes of professional and amateur Rwandan photographers. You can see it now at Somerset House at King's College in London, and I'm pleased to say that Dr. Zoe Norridge, the curator of the exhibition, joins us in the studio. Dr. Norridge, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Is it fair to say the West obviously had a great interest, Western newspapers had a great interest in shooting Rwanda? Did we shoot death and they shoot life?
We did and we didn't have a great interest, I think. When the killing was actually taking place, we weren't taking photographs. So we don't actually have any photographs of people with their arms raised holding machetes, or of sort of Interahamwe, the armed militia, throwing grenades into churches or into schools filled with terrified people. Those images are largely absent. What we do have are lots and lots of photographs of corpses. So corpses floating down the Akagera River, corpses by the sides of roads, corpses in states of various sort of decomposition, so skulls, rows of long bones in churches and memorial sites. The other thing we have in relation to Rwanda, of course, are the images of the refugees going into Congo, so those refugee camps that then were blighted by cholera and massive loss of life there. We don't have any images of the genocide taking place, as it were, actually from within Rwanda, from during those 3 months in 1994, when up to 1 million people died.
Well, on that point then, before we actually talk about the show, is there a record anywhere then of this genocide? Presumably Rwandan news itself was too busy in this civil war and this genocide to be happening to be able to document it.
And a lot of journalists were killed during the genocide as well. There was actually a British person in Rwanda at the time, Nick Hughes, who was the cameraman, was there in Kigali, and he's shot some really iconic footage from the top of the French school in central Kigali. He went up to this classroom that was quite high up. He looked across the valley. He saw a couple of people pleading for their lives on the road. He saw perpetrators walking up and down with machetes in hand, and then he saw them being killed with a machete. And he captured all of that on camera. He was actually running out of batteries at the time, so he's turning the camera on and off, and he manages to capture the moment of death on camera. And it's become so iconic because these are the only images we have of the deaths actually taking place.
And to return to the subtitle of your show, Death Then Life Now, we'll move on to the life. This was the show, I guess the genesis of the show was workshops by Western photographers for Rwandan amateur photographers. Maybe you can tell us how it came about and how you presumably want to show, and the Rwandan photographers in your show want to show, the life now part of the title of the exhibition.
I think the life now and the death then are actually intricately interwoven. Because the reason why the workshop came about was that I was looking for photographs of Rwandans that were showing them in their contemporary situations, that were showing the ways in which life had changed in Rwanda. And what I was finding were photographs of survivors again and again and again that focus on the wounds, that focus on the scars, that place the survivor next to piles of bodies, that place the survivor at grave sites and so on. So continually taking the survivor back to that moment in 1994. But the country that I was visiting, the country I was working in, the country I was doing research in, was very different, and I'd seen enormous change. So I started looking for Rwandan images, because I had a sense that actually the Rwandans would be doing things slightly differently. They'd be representing their own people quite differently, and I didn't find anything. And at that point, I got in touch with John Mbanda, who was the photojournalist at the New Times. And I said to him, John, what is going on? Why can't I find the images that I'm looking for? And he said, Zoe, there are two problems here. The first problem is that there's a lack of training in the country, so photographers are not getting professional training that they need. The second problem is that there's a lack of access to international networks. And I thought, as an academic, I think I could do something about this. And hence the idea for applying for funding to bring photographers over to facilitate this workshop in Kigali. So we got Andrew Asiebo to come over. Andrew's a Nigerian photographer, perhaps most well known this year for the work he's done on barbershops in West Africa. He had an exhibition at Tiwani Contemporary earlier this year. And he has wonderful, wonderful images infused with life, very much reflecting the urban reality of Nigeria today. And was really important for me to bring an African photographer, because I wanted to show that African photographers were leading the field in various different ways. So we had Andrew facilitating, and then we also had Brendan Bannon, who was an American photographer at the time based in Kenya. And he was coming with quite a different aesthetic to Andrew and was very complimentary to him.
And this, as you say, this is all about life. This is about especially the sort of bustling, hyper entrepreneurial spirit in the formerly war torn Kigali. This is a place that's pulling itself up by its bootstraps, and very visually. What do these photographs look like? What sort of characters are in these pictures?
Yeah, Kigali is incredibly vibrant. Every time I come, there's a new building, there's a new road, there's something else that's changed. We didn't actually set the agenda for the photographers. They decided what they wanted to do themselves. They proposed projects when they were applying to take part in the workshop, but then they decided what they wanted to work on. So there is an enormous amount of life. So, for example, Jacqueline Utagarama, one of the photographers who has an image in one of the posters, she chose to focus on women in business. Women doing roles that were traditionally employed by men. And she's got this wonderful image of a woman incredibly strong woman who just happened to be working in a shop, also incredibly beautiful, looking up into the light in the corner of the shot. She's wearing kind of a stripy T-shirt and you can really see the kind of the gorgeousness of her bone structure. But what really tickles me is that in the background, you also have the people who are working in the shop, who are looking at her, who are smiling, who are clearly engaging with the photographer. It's a lovely intimate moment. You can see that there's a Rwandan photographer there, that the Rwandan photographer has been talking to Mkinyi Rwanda, has been building a relationship, and then has caught this moment where there's a bit of direction, there's a bit of asking the woman to look in a certain direction and so forth, but there's also sort of spontaneity and joy
and laughter.
You're sort of
catching that moment halfway through
the
acting and the reality of it.
And that's in some of the other photographs too. So John Mbanda, who I mentioned earlier, John Mbanda, the photographer at New Times, he worked in a workshop. And John's news photographs are usually kind of politicians shaking hands, conferences, things like this. But the photographs he took in this workshop were of moments, were of movement, were of things that were just happening as he was there, becoming invisible amongst the spaces where people were working. So you've got somebody who's hawking fruit, who's walking through, who just turns to look at the photographer at that moment, and who kind of, you catch a glimpse of her eye, a glimpse of her life, again with this very intimate kind of knowing look.
And it seems like almost accidentally, curatorially, you're telling a different story. I mean, you know, it's called Death Then Life Now, the show, but luckily, of course, Rwandans seem to want to document some of the more vibrant, positive elements of their country rather than dwell on the past whilst at the same time living next to it. Is that noticeable in the photography of world? Is there a sense of sadness? Is there a sense of memory to the current vibrancy? And does that come across in the photographs?
What comes across in the photographs is a sense of complexity. Mm. So it's not that these are all shiny photographs of people having brilliant, happy lives. There's also a sense of enduring poverty, particularly in the rural areas. And we had three photographers who took part in the project who grew up in the Mbambazi orphanage, which is on the border of Rwanda and Congo. And those three photographers all chose to do projects that you could call sort of photography of social engagement, if you like. So Claudia Ngabire went to a very rural area and looked at cows and the role of cows in rural families. And what you see there, again, intimate portraits, but of people with their cows, living with those cows, cows often sharing some of the same living spaces as them, people who are still in sort of abject poverty, but trying to pull themselves out of that. Then Musa Uitonze, another of those young people who grew up in the orphanage, chose to work on street children in Kigali. That's a side of Kigali that as a foreigner you don't see because it's not apparent on the busy streets where you'll be walking. But it is a side of Kigali that still exists, and he wanted to advocate for those children with his photography. The government is currently in the process of closing some of the orphanages, and he wanted to question that decision and engage in some dialogue about that decision. But then you also have photographs of death in some ways, because you have Cyril Ndegeya. Cyril is a photojournalist with the East African, and he's been obsessed with photographing traffic accidents for years and years now. And so what we have from him are a series of shots of traffic, some showing how well regulated in some ways traffic is in Kigali, and others showing terrible crashes where lorries have toppled over and so on. And you see the debris that spread out across the road. You see a moto accident where the moto has been hit by a car. And what I think you see in those images is that these days in Rwanda, you're much more likely to die on the road than you are to die from a machete. And so it's a reflection on death, but death as it is today.
And death is an everyday thing that happens. There are car crashes in Los Angeles as much as there are in Kigali.
Yeah.
A car crash is almost a relief to normality after a genocide, almost, isn't it?
Yes. It's a strange
idea of someone that's been caught up in a genocide almost inevitably being obsessed with car crashes. Well, Zoe, thank you so much. That was Dr. Zoe Norridge, who's the curator of the new show Rwanda in Photographs, Death Then Life Now. It's on at Somerset House at King's College London. And there we have it, Andrew. Episode 247 of the Monocle Weekly. It's a wrap. That's me doing that thing that you do.
I don't know what that is. That's kind of like dusting your hands. Oh, I've pulled something off my microphone.
Broken the studio.
Well, nice show. I like Andrew Lycett a great deal.
Yes, it's really good. It's quite. I think his biography of Wilkie Collins is longer than any of Wilkie Collins' books, but that's no bad thing because but he also put a plot spoiler in, didn't he, about the Moonstone? I mean,
yes.
I know it's been out for 150 years, but you know.
But it's also interesting. I like the discipline of somebody like Andrew Lycett. How does he write so many of these very good books?
I know.
He must just be very good at sitting down and saying, okay, I'm on my own, but I'm going to write 10,000 words today.
I know. It's intense, isn't it?
And you and me, we're like, oh, another photo caption. Can't do that. No, we're not like that. But he's obviously. I admire the.
If we did all, commitment. If we wrote all the things we have to write and say on the radio and wrote down in the magazine, it would make a lot of books, I think.
Okay, good. So we can feel happy about it.
You can feel happy. Well, let's relax. We can rest easy. Phil Clay was very interesting. And it was interesting talking about his book, Redeployment. And it's tough, isn't it? After we switched off the microphones and we were all sitting in the studio, we were sort of saying it's tough to interview. It's such a tough subject to talk about when you write a book about the Iraq war, a war in which we are still engaged, or a part of the world in which we are still engaged militarily, at least. How to separate truth from fiction, and you know, a novelist from the soldier that he used to be. It's fraught with danger, but he was a nice man.
And I think he hinted that some people have got confused by reading about the characters and then muddling up what they think must be his politics as well, and confusing author and people, you know, featured in the book. But yeah, so a nice afternoon, Mr. Band.
All right, well, let's thank Danny Giacopelli, who produced the show, and Claire Urban, who's the studio manager. And we'll be here same time, same place next week. The Monocle Weekly team will return. But for the time being, for me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.